If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. There are few more appealing folk tales than the story of a gentlemanly outlaw roaming the forest with his band of merry men, robbing the rich to give to the poor. But where did the legend of Robin Hood come from? How come early versions of the story were much more grisly? And would the outlaw archer really have worn green tights? To answer your questions on Robin Hood for today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, I spoke to Dr. Sean McGlynn, a medieval historian and the author of Robin Hood, A True Legend.
I wanted to start us off today with a question that a lot of people have asked. So H.L. Neufeld has asked this, Belle Buchanan and Anna J. Morey have all asked, was Robin Hood a real person? I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah, straight to the heart of the matter, isn't it? We don't know, but while there are no official records of his life, this absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. For a start, the name may be real for the Robin Hood, but it's more likely a nickname for a common robber. Was there an actual real Robin Hood? Probably not. There are simply too many problems associated with the name of Robin Hood. But was he based on a real person? This is something I'll probably get back to a bit later, but I believe very strongly that he was based on a real person.
Ooh, a nice cliffhanger for listeners there. But let's start now with a question from Franchise505 on Instagram, who's asked, what's the first known literary reference we have to Robin Hood? And Ali Louisa on Instagram has also asked, is it true that the Robin Hood story wasn't written until the 15th century?
Okay, both really important questions as we move back to discover the origins of Robin Hood. So much of Robin Hood these days is taking the tales from they were written and moving them forward to how the story developed. But my interest is taking it back to the origins. And the first literary reference to Robin Hood is in William Langland's poem Piers Plowman from about 1381. It's an allegorical poem of theology and social satire. One character in it called Sloth says, I do not know my paternoster, our father, perfectly as the priest sings it, but I know my rhymes of Robin Hood. So that clearly shows that the tales of Robin Hood were known by the end of the 14th century. Now, if the Robin Hood stories were written down before the 15th century, we have not discovered any manuscripts of it. A whole basis of the Robin Hood legend lies in surviving texts from, as Aloysia says, from the mid-15th century onwards. These are commonly known as ballads or poems or short epics. The first of these survives from around 1450, 1465. As with so much of Robin Hood history, there is an awful lot of dispute, and we just haven't been able to pin down exact dates. And these original ones, stories, were actually found in a manuscript collection, which actually includes a prayer for protection against outlaws. So it's really appropriate. So we start with tales like Robin Hood and the Monk and the Death of Robin Hood from the 1450s to 1470s. Then we have other tales. Some people may have heard of Guy of Gisborne and Robin Hood and the Potter, talking about 1470 time. But our main source is A Jest of Robin Hood, and that's the longest tale, and that's the basis for the Robin Hood stories. And that was published at the end of the 15th century and early 16th century. This collects tales from about 1450 to 1465 and is considered the earliest part of the legend.
It's probably worth mentioning at this point, isn't it, that the tales come from, as you say, primarily the 15th century, but when were they set?
Again, this is one of those problems, because even though those tales were from the 15th century, the written text, there were plays before them that were performed, and we actually have a play text from 1475, 1476, and we know that a play was performed in Exeter in 1427 because you have record of payments to the performers. So the texts were probably, of the plays were probably there beforehand, but they haven't survived. Now, as to when they were set, you can imagine there's a couple of problems with this, because the origins of the stories probably go back to the early 13th century, and each phase of development of the Robin Hood legend could be set in their own time. So there might be a story from 1280s, 1320s, 1380s, 1420s, and so on. Just as we do today, we update stories and television programs, don't we? Old television series from the past are updated to the modern age. Now, one of the biggest clues, which I think is a bit of a false clue, is that in the story, The Jest of Robin Hood, it talks about King Edward. Now, there were three King Edwards from about 1272 for the following century. So it could be Edward I, Edward II, Edward III. But if the stories are a little bit later, 1460 or so, it could actually be Edward IV. So it doesn't really help us. We don't have that. We don't have anything to pinpoint it on. So even if we focus on language or focus on some of the social descriptions within Robin Hood that say, or that might say what's going on in society, it only tells you where that particular one is from. And we don't know if it stayed the same or if it moved forward in time. So if we don't really know, and my best guess is that they were largely adopted for the times they were set in.
And these kind of canonical early texts, is the Robin Hood story in these texts one that we would recognize today? This outlaw gentleman stealing from the rich, giving to the needy with a band of merry men. Is that the story we have in these early texts?
Not entirely, no. And again, that's part of the element of Robin Hood being developed. In the earliest Robin Hood texts, as we've established from the 15th century that survive, we have a Robin Hood character we can identify, but the idea that he stole from the rich to give to the poor is only given in the very last two lines of this whole long poem. Very briefly, he said, and he did the poor much good. And that's it. The whole basis of the whole Robin Hood stealing from the rich to give to the poor is taken from that. Some of the chronicles later make reference to that. But he was also a much more violent character in those scripts than we would expect today. And his men were more violent because the medieval audiences loved their blood and guts.
Are there any examples of that you could share with us?
Yes, certainly. Two. In Robin Hood and the Monk, Little John and Much the Miller's Son, two of the merry men of Robin Hood's band, they kill a monk, but with the monk is a young novice, a boy who's just joined the holy orders, or trying to, and they behead him because he's a witness, which is not the sort of nice behavior we're familiar with from the films and stories. But Robin Hood himself in Guy of Gisborne, he kills his enemy, chops off his head, and then disfigures the face with a knife, specifically called an Irish knife for some reason, disfigures the face, and then puts the head on top of his bow. But violent, yes. And if we think about the chanson de geste, the songs of chivalry from the time, we very often see accounts of knights being cleaved in two from shoulder to saddle, and ears and eyes popping out, guts spilling out, really, really violent stuff. But then it's not so different from today with the horror films and the violence in video games and the like. So the violence was part of the entertainment value of the early Robin Hood.
So I'd like to move us on now to a question from Traceka, which is pretty open-ended. So I'll let you interpret this how you want to. But Traceka has asked, is there any fact in the fiction?
I think the origins, there are facts. The actual stories, I think, I treat them largely as fiction. But is there any fact to that? It's quite difficult to determine because, as we're already establishing, we're not even sure when the legend is set. So how do you confirm facts on that time? And as I said, different writers will have set the story in different times. And we spoke just a moment ago of the giving to the rich, stealing from the rich, sorry, to give to the poor. And the lines in the Chronicles, as I mentioned earlier, was, "For he was a very good outlaw and did poor men much good." Now, I refer to the Chronicles there, and a really influential one which kind of tries to put facts onto the fiction is from a Scottish chronicler, John Major, in the early 16th century. And he said of Robin Hood, and this is written in a chronicle, so it's written as fact, even if the chronicler may have got his facts wrong, just as newspapers and that do. And he says, "Robin Hood would allow no woman to suffer injustice, nor would he steal from the poor, but rather he enriched them from the plunder seized from abbots. I condemn the robberies of this man, but of all the robbers, he was most human." So that becomes fact, even though we're not sure that it was fact at the time. And this chronicle from the early 16th century is written 300 years, three centuries after the original Robin Hood legend seems to have started. So trying to get the facts from that is very difficult. But that's as far away as we are today from Dick Turpin in the early 18th century. So that gives you a scale of the time distance involved. And I think the stories of Robin Hood from the 15th century have to be treated extremely cautiously as evidence, but I think they're more like should be considered more as entertainment. Now, I'll just add to that a really important point, which is what has led me in some ways into my research into Robin Hood. Lots of the stories from, say, the 13th century are about heroes such as Hereward the Wake, Eustace the Monk, Fulke Fitzwarren. These were very popular figures in the real time. Now, the stories around them are fantastical, real sword and sorcery, Game of Thrones stuff. So slaying monstrous beasts, rescuing princesses from dragons, really far-fetched sword and sorcery stuff. But they also had elements of fact in them, and all the stories were based on genuine, real historical figures. So therefore, it is not a great leap to think that the Robin Hood legend in the 13th century is also based on an original Robin Hood.
Well, that leads me on very nicely to a question from Sean Hall, who has asked, just how many criminals, rebels, and nobles is Robin Hood a composite of? Do you see Robin Hood as a composite of different people, or do you perhaps have a couple of people in mind that you think were real inspirations?
I definitely think there's some real inspirations, but the composite point is an important one. And over time, I think that's what he has become. So he'll be based on a number of people. And this is where, you know, a huge amount of the fun lies in Robin Hood studies, you know, looking at all these possibilities. Now, of course, Robin Hood was an outlaw, so we look at criminals. I think that's not such a strong path to pursue in a way. Robin Hood became like a nickname for criminals. That's how we know the legend was established. So there are lots of Robin Hoods who are criminals. And they're all over the place. It's a bit like calling an electrician Sparks, or that type of name that goes with the job. Now, we have criminals from the New Yorkshire from the early 1220s. There's one in the records called Robert Hood Fugitive. But there's lots of Robert Hoods and lots of Robin Hoods who are in criminal records. And he possibly may have been Robert of Wetherby, some historians think, who was, we think, was hung in 1225. But the sheriff who arrested him later became sheriff of Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire. There was no actual sheriff of Nottingham till 1449. So even then, history divides. And the trouble with criminals is that they are criminals and they're not heroes. They're violent, nasty characters. And with Robin Hood, we need a hero. So I think we need to be looking elsewhere. On the noble side, this idea of Robin Hood as a noble character, the famous one is the Earl of Huntington. Many people have heard of Robin Hood as the Earl of Huntington. But that has to be dismissed. There's no truth to that, because that was only an invention of the around 1600, so nearly four centuries after the original stories. Again, this is really interesting, because Robin Hood, as we know, is the everyday hero for everyday people. But in the Tudor age, because he was so popular, the upper classes wanted to appropriate him to themselves and make him their hero. You know, the hoi polloi, the ordinary chaps can find another one. Well, we want him as one of ours. So they elevate him in status to this idea that he's the Earl of Huntingdon. So it's a social grab, really, for the upper classes. When it comes to people like rebels, I think we're getting really close to Robin Hood there. I think it's a really interesting category. There are a couple of candidates that stand out here. There's Roger of Godbird from the mid-13th century. Now, this is the time of Simon de Montfort and a baronial revolt against Henry III. Simon de Montfort was cut to pieces famously in a battle when he lost. Now, Roger Godbird was on his side and therefore was on the losing side, but he continued the political struggle against the king and the government. Now, he therefore is both a political hero to some while being an outlaw against the governments. He works very well, and I think he's important in the story of Robin Hood, but he's a little bit too late in that time. If we go back to 1216 time, we have another character called William of Kentham. Now, he was a ordinary forester-type chap, but this was a time when the French invaded England, and they occupied half of England for a year and a half. And it's like this forgotten invasion. And the part of England that was occupied, William was fighting a guerrilla warfare against the French. And therefore, he was an outlaw because he was opposing French rule, but he's a hero for the English resistance. And we have endless chronicle, well, not endless, but plenty of chronicle accounts and government records talking about William of Kentham. And indeed, one chronicle of the time, Roger of Wendover, says that William was in the forest ambushing the French and with his band of bowmen. So it's kind of, and that is the only time we have that specific link in any chronicle to Robin Hood and the bows in that way. So yeah, I think the rebel element is more important in the story.
This search for the real Robin Hood to kind of nominate who he might have been based on is really interesting to me, because it's so tantalizing. But from the way that you spoke about the stories earlier as potentially entertainment, could it just be that this idea of Robin Hood wasn't inspired by anybody? It was an archetype, it was a stereotype, it was a fictional character. And that actually leads me on to a question from Tom Bullock, who said, could Robin Hood just have been made up to give people false hope that someone was fighting on their behalf?
Well, the beauty of Robin Hood, it can be all things to all men. What you said is absolutely true about, could be an archetype figure. Indeed, he might even be based on the wood spirit becoming personified as a person. And that is a real possibility. My argument against that, and I think it's, you know, I wouldn't dismiss it at all, because I think it's very much a possibility. But my argument against that is, as I explained earlier, that these famous tales from the 13th century, which is when the Robin Hood legend developed, for all their fanciful inventions, are based on real characters. So the real person is the way in for people to identify and to be entertained. So I think that's important. I don't think he was created for false hope, but I do think he was taken on and engaged with as someone who can offer hope against injustice. I think that was a really important point about the Robin Hood legend. When the existing tales, it's a time of political turmoil. For example, we have the Wars of the Roses are starting. We've got war in the land. People are complaining about justice not being fulfilled. So people need a hero. Now, that works in the 15th century, but it works any time, doesn't it? It works today, it works in the century before the Wars of the Roses, it can be applied any time. So he is very much a figure of hope, because he's going to rectify the wrongs of society, and that's important. So, and it's quite interesting. We have an example from 1441 in Norfolk at a time of unrest. There's a gang of yeomen and labourers who are having trouble with one of their local gentry, and they gather together and they shout, "We are Robin Hood's men, war, war, war." So this idea of justice as well is important because of the criminal element. Lots of people thought that the criminal system was corrupt. It was, really. And that punishments could be very unfair. So they're trying to correct that. But law and punishment was very, very harsh. They didn't really have a network of prisons like we do today. So they had to make the punishment clear and harsh as a warning to others. But sometimes it went too far. And of course, the people with the money could bribe judges and bribe witnesses and the like and get away with crimes. So people wanted to have some way of developing hope against the system. And even when it's not real, even though the characters might not be, might not change the system, as an audience, even like today, we like to see the baddie get his comeuppance. So the Robin Hood character provides that kind of satisfaction.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But it's really important to remember with Robin Hood and social message and all the rest of it, that he's still entertainment. And that's the first and most important reason for his success. He's an attractive character. We keep adapting him to new times, and that keeps him fresh and alive. And he's basically one of us helping the likes of us, which we always identify with.
So I wonder if now we could talk about some of the merry men, the other characters in the story. Toby on Twitter has asked, is there any factual basis to any of the other characters in Robin Hood? S. Hughes on Instagram has asked whether some of these characters were only added in later versions of the story.
Familiar Robin Hood characters who are not in the original manuscripts are Maid Marian, who's from around 1500, Friar Tuck, although he is mentioned in one of the plays, and Alan a Dale, the minstrel, the singing minstrel. He doesn't appear until the 17th century. So, you know, very late indeed. The Maid Marian character is basically a fiction figure. She was present in the May Day festivals, the celebrations of May Day. She seems to have been brought in around 1500. And it's very possible she had her own traditional stories behind her as well, separate from Robin Hood. Because we hear in 1509 about how the Maid Marian stories are combined with the Robin Hood stories. And in the May Day festivals, they are the king and queen of misrule. So that's how they come together, but nothing based on fact. The Sheriff of Nottingham, as I said, there was no Sheriff of Nottingham until 1449. There's a Sheriff of Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire. Of course, he's the bad guy, the official figure of authority who people can rally against. Little John, he probably had his own story tradition, but whether he's real or not, unlikely in that sense. But we do have Little John's in the records from 1313 and from 1292, Little John as a criminal. So there are records of him, but again, it's a popular name. I think the most interesting one is Friar Tuck in many ways, actually. Now, he was first known as in 1417. And the name Friar Tuck was used in a criminal record of that year for the leader of a criminal gang in Sussex and Surrey. And we know who this person was. He was Robert Stafford, who was a chaplain and a priest. And the scribe writing the record, the judicial record, said, this is an unusual name in common parlance of Friar Tuck. So that may have been based on some element. More likely, I'm afraid to say, though, it's more like Robert Stafford was being applied to the fictitious character.
So he was a chaplain that ran a gang?
Yeah. And it's quite remarkable, if you look at the crime in the 13th century, how many priests and people in the clergy were outright criminals. I mean, a shocking proportion of them. It's truly astonishing. Getting up all sorts of no good, and blackmail, thieving, violence, financial irregularities, But we have to remember, so many people were in the church at that time as a main form of employment. And that's reflected then in the crime. It's a really interesting study to see how many people in the church were not just moral criminals, as it were, but actual violent gang criminals. It's a huge number.
Fascinating. So next we have a couple of questions about royal figures in Robin Hood. I suspect that these may have been inspired by the Disney animated film of Robin Hood and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, because as you said, the setting for Robin Hood in the original stories is not that clear. But by the time we get to these later iterations that a lot of people are familiar with, we've got two main royal figures, haven't we, which is King John and King Richard. So Leslie Brown on Facebook has asked why King Richard, the Lionheart, the first, generally comes out as a good guy in most versions of the stories. I think Leslie Brown is not a fan of Richard the Lionheart. Okay. But I wonder if you have an opinion on that.
It's interesting because the setting of the Robin Hood story in King Richard's reign comes from this chronicler I mentioned earlier, John Major, from the early 16th century. And he says, to his best estimate, as he says, that the stories were set in the reign of Richard the Lionheart. Of 10 years of his reign, he was only in the country for under a year. So he's an absent king. I excuse Richard of this as a negative thing in my book, Blood Cries of Fire. I explain why it was important for him to be out of the kingdom and leave it to the rule to other people. He had very important interests that served the country by fighting in France. So Prince John then becomes the bad guy, because when Richard is away and on the noble and pious cause of crusade, as they saw it in the Middle Ages, John tries to take power, take the throne from Richard. And then Robin Hood is loyal to Richard and opposed to the evil doings of Prince John. And this is quite important because it allows Robin Hood to fight against the enemies of the king, to be loyal to the king, a loyal subject of the king. When there's something wrong with the country in the Middle Ages, people would protest against the king's evil counselors. They'd never say it's the king himself. There's a bit of a safety mechanism there as well. And this is what Robin Hood is doing. He is being loyal to the true king and stopping the evil usurper John from taking his place. Now, on the other point about the King John's reign itself, from 1199 to 1216, I think this is when the legend really takes off with Robin Hood, and it's in the reign of King John.
Modern Gistory on Twitter has asked about the reign of King John and has asked, did the administration of King John really provoke banditry, which is a really intriguing question.
There's always an element of banditry, and the worse the government is, the more breakdown in law and order there is. Actually, I would take the point to take it a lot further. So bad was the administration of King John that it wasn't his way he ruled the country in itself that led to banditry, but it led to the French being invited to come in and take over the country and for Prince Louis of France to become the new King of England. So it's even worse than just causing banditry. It created a French invasion and occupation of England for 18 months. And it's therefore that gives William of Kensham, who is this chap I mentioned earlier, the chance to fight against the French and become established as, I think, as perhaps the best real life inspiration behind Robin Hood. But yes, it's beyond bad administration, so catastrophic that the French are invited to come in and rule England.
We've got a question now from Paul Orton on Facebook, who has asked, why is Robin Hood commonly known as Robin of Locksley? And can you sort out the disagreement between Sheffield and Nottingham on Robin's origins? I have to say, Sean, I've got some skin in the game here because I am from Sheffield. So what's your take?
Yes, this is a sensitive area, as I've often discovered when being interviewed alongside people representing Nottingham Tourist Board and the like. Because it's a huge industry and people want to lay claim to Robin Hood, it's very lucrative. They'd be proud of the association. Of course, it's a huge money spinner. The whole Locksley element, well, this is, again, late 16th century, so it's much later invention, don't even know which Loxley it is. The only one we're aware of is one in, there's one in Yorkshire, but not in Nottinghamshire. So it's disputed. Much effort is put in looking at the text to discover the place names, because a lot of the place names are real. I mentioned Piers Plowman earlier, which is a strange tale, but it's set in Shropshire. The name places are all genuine and real. So we have that in Robin Hood. But again, the story is there from the 15th century. Now, two and a half centuries before, were the stories set in that same area, Nottingham and Sherwood, before or not? We don't know. It may very well be the case that the story settled there after two centuries, and that's the only surviving manuscript we have. So we fixate on that. And it's always an odd thing, because Sherwood Forest, even when it's a lot bigger in the Middle Ages, we automatically connect Sherwood Forest with Robin Hood. But the whole forest in the Middle Ages could be crossed at its longest point in a day. So it wasn't very big. Now, again, using the tales as evidence is dodgy, because if you think about it, the sheriff of Nottingham or whoever with all his men must be very incompetent if they can't find Robin Hood's men, who's always given it as a band of 140 in such a small area. And it goes beyond camouflage, doesn't it? And when you think about it, in winter, the leaves are all gone, so the people are exposed. And all the smoke from the fires of the camps, you know, they have to cook the venison they've poached somehow. It's impossible not to find someone in that small area. And if you look at other outlaws from history, like Jesse James and the like, they covered huge areas to avoid being caught. So no one's going to set up in just one area of Nottingham or Derbyshire or wherever, and it's like commuting into work through an ambush point, which everybody knows about. It's not realistic. I think we shouldn't invest as much as we have done in assuming that these are definitely the places, just because you have this one source of evidence. Well, even literary evidence, not actual chronicle evidence, but literary evidence on it.
Well, Hamish Ross has asked whether there are similar stories from other regions in the UK.
And that's a really good question. And yes, which kind of reinforces the point I've just made earlier about settling on Nottinghamshire. The Robin Hood tales is important, fits in perfectly with the whole tradition of medieval outlaw tales, of which there are plenty. So we have Hereward the Wake mentioned in Cambridgeshire, Fulk Fitzwarren in the Welsh Marshes and elsewhere. And the popular story of Adam Bell, Clem of the Cloth, and William of Cloudesley around Carlisle. And even Willoughby of the Weald has an oral folklore tradition in Kent. So, yes, different areas will have these different stories. Again, which makes the fixation on Nottingham slightly dubious, I would think.
And broadening things out even more, BL Chaplin on Instagram has asked about Robin Hood type tales in other cultures and other countries.
And I would imagine every society at all times in history, present and past, will have their own type of characters. I don't know a little bit about a couple of them. Tantia Bill is known as a Robin Hood of India. Gaspard de Best is known as a Robin Hood of Provence. Johannes Buchler is known as a Robin Hood of Germany. In their own countries. This is not names we are putting on them, but the names they've adopted for themselves. So yes, they absolutely do. An interesting, Tantia Bill and Johannes Buchler were independent fighters, rather like William of Kensham, but also we have this Robin Hood connection. I think more distortedly, we do come across as criminals being called the Robin Hood. So Billy the Kid, Jesse James, we have those. Less approvingly, we have Al Capone and Bonnie and Clyde, Robin and Marion. But even the truly evil Pablo Escobar was known as a Robin Hood figure. He's universal, absolutely.
Leslie Brown on Facebook has asked another question, which is that in many of the historical stories, Robin also takes from the church as well, which is something you mentioned earlier. And how would those stories have been received in an era possibly before the Reformation?
This is interesting in a number of ways. The church was wealthy, owned anything, you know, a quarter of the land in England, and the bishops and abbots were wealthy landowners. And of course, the church is meant to help the poor and help distribute charity and the like. And in so doing, if they fail to do so, they're criticized. So there's huge debates in the church about the church and money, and was the church allowed to have money, or should they all be poor? And of course, when they weren't giving enough money to the poor and were traveling around in their riches, it created resentment. But interestingly, at the time of these Robin Hood tales from the mid-15th century, we have a movement in England known as the Lollards, heretics, who like precursors in some ways to the Reformation just mentioned in the 16th century. And they were very much opposed to the wealth of the church. In the Jest of Robin Hood, Robin tells his men, okay to attack and take money off these rich abbots, but don't take it off poor knights or farmers or ordinary folk. And indeed, one of the, surprisingly, the least known but tale of Robin Hood, which is the absolutely at the heart of the Robin Hood original tales, is one of a knight who borrows money from an abbey, the Abbey of St. Mary, and is unable to pay the money back. And it's not one of these great rollicking adventures where there's archery competitions and swashbuckling and all the rest of it. It's actually a financial tale of, it's a bit like a bank advert, really, or a mortgage loan advert on the television. It's very dry, actually. But it's all about money from the church and how Robin helps this poor knight pay back the money to the church. So, yes, there are a universal target of criticism, a bit like today we might talk about fat cats and corporations or you know, people with an awful lot of money, figures of resentment, and therefore targets of both literary and actual physical attacks.
So now I want to ask you two of what are possibly my favourite questions of this podcast, which come from Melanie V. Davis and AgroBiodiverse, who have asked, did he really wear a green outfit with a feather in his cap? And AgroBiodiverse has asked, what's with the tights?
Okay. Sartorial history is not my thing, but the costume of Robin Hood seems to be just basically based on later medieval clothing as depicted in manuscript illustrations. So obviously green is the colour you want in a forest if you're hiding for camouflage. But actually at one point in the jest, the men are dressed in bright red, which is not what you want when you're trying to hide from your enemy, which again goes to show that I think you should take the jest not too seriously as evidence. But actually, there's actually more to this than one might think, because in the final counter of the jest, King Edward, when he resolves himself with Robin Hood and they're all great pals and slapping each other on the back, buys some Lincoln green cloth to be dressed in. So this Lincoln green cloth is a sign of the wealth of and the importance of the textile industry. And it's associated with the middle classes because of the type of business it is. So this cloth making and Lincoln green and all the rest of it associates Robin with the middle classes. Now, Robin Hood is therefore identified as a hero of the bourgeois or the middle classes, the merchants, artisans and that, just as the knights have their heroes on horseback with swords and charging into battle, now Robin Hood becomes the hero of the middle classes with their concerns about loans and the cloth industry and the like. So, there's an element of social commentary there, actually.
Next, we've got a question that might seem strange when we're talking about a fictional character, which is one of the most searched for queries on the internet, which is, where is Robin Hood buried?
Well, we talked about the concerns of heritage and tourist industries because they all want to lay claim to it. The main one is that he's been buried in a private estate at Kirklees Park in West Yorkshire. But ground radar shows no sign of soil disturbance. There's nothing to that. And it gets kind of clutching at straws, really, because there's an old stone grave in St. Nicholas Church in Locksley in Warwickshire, and that's cited as possibly his, quote, you know, air quotation marks, grave, just because it's an old coffin and it says Locksley. So we don't know. I mean, if he existed where he's buried, we don't know. But the story around Kirklees Abbey is that Robin, at the end of his days, went to the abbey to have his blood lit there as a health process. And his kinswoman was the prioress. But she tricks him. And with this character called Red Roger, they trick him and kill him. His blood starts flowing thinly and he realizes he's about to die. Red Roger then runs Robin Hood through and finishes him off. But before he does so, Robin manages to kill him, leaving his corpse to be eaten by the dogs. And as Robin prepares for death, he gives his burial instructions to Little John. Set my bright sword at my head, my arrows at my feet, and lay my yew bow by my side. Of course, it's all made up. But famously, we have the later variation where Robin is on his deathbed, and he tells Little John, I'll shoot my bow and bury me where the arrow lands, which is a wonderfully romantic way of looking at it. But let's find the real Robin Hood first, if we can.
So moving forward a few centuries, Ali Louisa has asked which film or TV series you think is the most realistic, or we can perhaps just say best, portrayal of Robin Hood that we've had so far.
This is an easy one for me. I mean, I like quite a few. I think Kevin Costner film Prince of Thieves is good fun. The Russell Crowe one is good fun. Some problems with the accents there, settling on which part of the world Russell Crowe's from. But my favourite is definitely from 1976, Robin and Marian, with Sean Connery and Audrey Hepburn. This is the most human Robin Hood. It's a realistic, it's not an over-the-top, jumping through the air, doing cartwheels and shooting off 10 arrows at a time. It's kind of set in reality, as it were. And it's a down-to-earth portrayal, and I actually love that film.
I'd have to fight you to defend Kevin Costner there, but we'll move on. And Leah Falcon has asked what impact the Robin Hood myth has had down the centuries.
Well, it's huge, and it's as much as ever now, it would seem. We have two great heroes in this country, King Arthur and Robin Hood. Robin Hood is very recognisable all around the world and adapted all around the world. He went a bit quiet in the 18th century, kind of went into semi-retirement in the 18th century. But then when Walter Scott's famous novel Ivanhoe came out in 1820, which was a massive success, Robin Hood appears in there, not as a main character, but he is in the story. And that just, there was an explosion of popularity of Robin Hood stories. And in fact, at one time in London in the 1820s, there were 5 theatres simultaneously showing Ivanhoe at the same time, you know, all at the same time. So is that popular? And he's there again, you know, during the Cold War, for example. Both the left and the right can see him as a hero of their cause, you know, fighting for the good or fighting against tyranny. We take your pick. And even now, there's a series called Arrow, which is a reinvention of a comic figure from the last century, which is very successful. So he keeps being adapted throughout the ages and will continue to do so.
Well, that leads me on to our last question from Brendan Mitchell, which is just, why has the tale of Robin Hood endured for so long?
Well, we always need a hero to right wrongs, don't we? We always have, and we always will do, against those who rule unjustly and maliciously, championing the cause of the oppressed against those people. He's a way to right the wrongs, to give a sense of satisfaction that even if it doesn't happen in real life, we have the satisfaction of it happening in entertainment or art. But it's really important to remember with Robin Hood and the social message and all the rest of it, that he's still entertainment. And that's the first and most important reason for his success. He's an attractive character. We keep adapting him to new times. And that keeps him fresh and alive. And he's basically one of us helping the likes of us, which we always identify with.
That was Sean McGlynn, the author of Robin Hood, A True Legend. Thanks to everybody who submitted a question for today's episode. And if you'd like to send one in for a future episode, make sure to follow us on social media at History Extra, where you'll see weekly shout-outs for this series. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt.